funny when you're standing to the side and you start speaking softly and you forget your microphone's already on. It's like, whoa, I can hear myself. Anyway. What gives your life meaning? I want you to picture yourself, it shouldn't be too hard because it's just come out of winter, picture yourself waking up on a cold winter's morning. Okay. And you go, you lie in bed and it's not very inviting to get out. And you say, what is the point of getting up? Why don't I just pull the covers over myself and hide from the world? But you drag yourself up and you stumble over to the wardrobe and you look, and why do you need so many shirts? Why do we have so many things there? I mean, it's pointless. But you pull on something warm and you shuffle off through the cold, reasonably cold house. Hopefully your house is insulated, it's not too frozen. But you've spent so much money and so much effort on this house thing, don't you? And then you get to the front door and you open the door and you step out into the cold and you breathe out. And there's a mist forms, a vapour. You can picture it, and then it's gone. That is what the teacher says life is like. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Or more literally, it's a vapour. A vapour. Nothing but a vapour. That breath, gone, means nothing. Futility, frustration, absolutely meaningless. And some of you might be thinking, well, what is this on about? Maybe you're not a Christian, maybe you're visiting wherever you're from, even maybe you haven't ventured into this part of the Bible before. I thought, you know, it's meant to be a message of hope. But God, by His Holy Spirit, has chosen to include this book of existential angst in the Bible. The Bible is a collection of 66 books, all inspired by God's Spirit, but written by different people over a thousand years. And Ecclesiastes dates back more than hundreds and hundreds of years before Christ. This is real ancient wisdom. You know, sometimes these days people go, oh, wow, there's some ancient wisdom. Well, this is ancient wisdom. And we see who it's written by there. And the very first, so I encourage you to open up to page 658, to Ecclesiastes. We're told it's written by, these are the words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So the son of David could also be descendant of David. So this could be David's famous son, Solomon, super wise guy, famously wise. Or it could be another king after him, because he never says his name, we're not sure. And the structure of this book is fairly simple. You've got a very brief introduction saying this is the teacher, this is what he says. There's a brief conclusion at the end, which is really important. We'll look at that in a few weeks' time. And most of it, this teacher, this old man, wise old man, talking directly to us. I don't know how you feel about sitting at the feet of a wise old man listening to him. Some of you might be excited by that. Some of you might think it sounds like the last thing you'd ever like to do. It's interesting. These are the words of the US novelist Tom Wolfe, who I believe was not a Christian, about this book, Ecclesiastes. And Wolfe writes, "Of all that I have ever seen or learned, this book, Ecclesiastes, seems to me the noblest, the wisest, the most powerful expression of man's life upon this earth, and also the highest flower of poetry, eloquence and truth. I'm not given to dogmatic judgments," he says, "in the matter of literary creation, but if I had to make one, I could say that Ecclesiastes is the single greatest piece of writing I have ever known. Wisdom expressed in it is the most lasting and profound." It's quite a statement, isn't it? Encourage us. Let's take time to look at this. We're going to today look from verse 12. which is where the teacher starts addressing us most directly. We're going to look at the end of chapter 1, just as an introduction to jump around, look at the overall thrust of the book. Next week, we're going to look at the teacher. He's a king, he's got resources, okay, he could do what he likes. He goes in and he tries experiencing everything. He tries testing it out that way. And in 2 weeks' time, we're going to look at the final chapters of Ecclesiastes as he reflects more on the later part of life. So we see in verse 12, he says, I, the teacher, was king over Jerusalem. He's already made it, this guy. He is king. He's got the power, the riches. He's not struggling to get there. He has it. He says, I, the teacher, was king over Jerusalem, over Israel and Jerusalem, and I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom. So he's devoted himself to wisdom, okay, and to study. He's not, you know, we get slack, you know, we get too busy with the rest of life, but this guy is devoted. He wants to, he'll do anything to figure it all out. What's he trying to figure out? All that is done under heaven. It's not a small project. He doesn't just want to understand how his family's working. He doesn't just want to understand his kingdom. He wants to understand all that is done under heaven. This is refrained throughout Ecclesiastes, under heaven, under the sun, which tells us about both what the teacher is looking at and where he's looking from. So it tells us what he's looking at. He's looking at not just the small bits, he's trying to look at the whole of life, the whole of the earth, and make sense of that. But he's looking from under heaven. He's down here with us, with you and me, looking around, trying to make sense of it with his own eyes, with his own wisdom. He wants to see what he sees, make it up his mind for himself. It's not that the teacher doesn't believe that there is God above him. It's just that he wants to work it all out for himself and feel he's done it. And he's, you know, you could see that he acknowledges God in the end of the verse. Lovely conclusion here. What a heavy burden God has laid on me. He's not an optimist, is he? He's also not terribly modest. I have seen all things that are done under the sun. I've got it. I've figured it out, he's saying. I've seen all things that are done under the sun. And his conclusion, all of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. It's the big theme of this book, chasing after the wind, meaninglessness. And we've already seen it in the introduction, which Bob read to us. The teacher seeks to rip away at the foundations that many people rely on to give their lives meaning. I don't know, what motivates you? Where do you turn to try to get meaning in your life? I mean, I know for me, one big motivator is the thought that I can make a difference, that what I do has real significance. But to me, the teacher says from verse 3, well, what does a man gain for all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Get yourself in perspective, Michael. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north, and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where streams come from, there they return again. Really? Do you really think you can make a difference? Will you change the way the sun and the planets move? You're only one of the billions of people on this place. You and I, we are very, 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 very small. On a global scale, what we do won't change things after all. It won't make a big difference. It won't be significant. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can see. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear it's full of hearing. What's been done will be again. And what has been done will be done again. For what has been will be again. There's nothing new under the sun. The governments will come. The governments will go. We think these days we get all excited about our new technologies. Do you remember people used to get all excited about Nokia mobile phones? Nokia's just gone. Out of phones now. Do you remember people getting all excited? Oh, we have a TV this big. Wasn't that exciting? And you know what's filling up the tip at the moment? Big TVs, because there's a new thing come along. I need the eye never has its full of seeing. The ear never has its full of hearing. It's all just another thing, and it's the externals look different, but the inside is just the frustration just going nowhere. meaningless. But we all still keep seeking after meaning. Some people seek it through accumulating possessions. When I walk around the craft group on Thursday mornings, there's a hunger for significance there. There seems to be a hunger for people to remember them, that will give their life meaning. So one thing I notice is if somebody comes, one of the ladies comes in and tells a story about somebody who their daughter or their granddaughter or somebody found a piece of handiwork they'd done and how wonderful it made it, how they started talking about this, the lady who'd done it, if she was alive or if she'd already died, and how it really gave meaning and lasted as a legacy. I think we'd all like to think, we'll leave a legacy and that'll give some more meaning. People will remember us and appreciate us after we die. But seriously, look around, says the teacher. Verse 11. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. It's brutal, isn't he? Your legacy is not going to give your life lasting significance. I will be forgotten. He says, life under the sun is meaningless. Going back to his summary there in 14, all of them are meaningless, are chasing after the wind. He continues, what is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. The teacher looks around and concludes, well, things that are broken, there's more things broken and messed up in this world that can be counted. If you're looking for justice, you're going to keep looking pretty hard, because life is not fair. Don't expect to see real justice. I got upset about losing justice when they cut foreign aid funding and stuff like that. But why am I surprised? There is not justice. Chapter 4, he expands more on this. Start of chapter 4. Again I looked, he said, and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power is on the side of the oppressors. They have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who have died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has never seen the evil under the sun. And I saw that all labour and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbour. Four motivations. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The teacher looks around at the world. He was a king. He could do a bit. He could do a lot more than you or I could to bring a bit of justice to where he was. But there will still be injustice conquering. He says, "Don't expect to see justice and get meaning from that. Don't expect anyone to remember you and to get meaning from that." He looks at the lives of people around him. Looks at the world under the sun, and says it's meaningless, utterly meaningless. Philosopher, great Greek philosopher who lived a bit after the teacher, he stated, well, the unexamined life is not worth living. But recently, US writer Kurt Vonnegut asked, well, but what if the examined life is a clunker as well? And the teacher, he looks at it, he answered that question thousands of years before Kurt Vonnegut asked it. Back in chapter 1 in our thing there, he says, I thought to myself, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. You can hear his pride, it is old wisdom. You can hear his wisdom, you can hear his despair. it's not all despair. He does say, gives some positive advice for life, hints that point to a way out of his whirlpool of despair, but we don't want to jump there too quickly. We want to give time to ponder and get the force of the teacher's main point of his wisdom. So let me tell you two reasons why I'm really, really glad that Ecclesiastes is in the Bible, that God in His Spirit has given it to us. The first one is that I'm really glad Ecclesiastes is here because it means I'm not scared of the intellectual minefields that are out there. I'm not scared of philosophy. I'm not scared of postmodernism. Look, we've discovered something new. Life is pointless. Duh. I'm not scared of existentialism or pessimism. I remember in high school, my English literature teacher introduced us to Joseph Conrad's novel, The Heart of Darkness. And I told Miriam this, and she said, no, that's not just a novel. That is a seminal piece. Miriam's my wife, who does all the post-grad study and PhDs and that sort of stuff on literature. And she says, no, that's a touchstone text, the core of the canon from 20th century literature and philosophy. So why is it so influential? Well, it's influential because so many people can relate to it. In the heart of darkness, life looks chaotic and meaningless, and then you get the concluding words on life by Kurtz, the great wise man of the heart of darkness. And his conclusion is the horror. The horror. Life as it's presented is not ordered or purposeful as people used to believe and used to be the assumed in society. Life is meaningless and chaotic and unfair. And I remember my English lit teacher having a sort of smug look as he told us this. Sort of the arrogance I can identify with, and the teacher definitely has. You know, look, I know so much better. We can demolish your world views, demolish the way you see the world when you actually get a bit of wisdom, bit of reality of the pointlessness of it all. But I knew Conrad's despair and pessimism were not new. They're not a threat to God. They're not a threat to Christianity. God himself has included this pondering of life, trying to make sense of it just under the sun, in the Bible. The despair of the postmodern relativistic society today is not new. There is nothing new under the sun. You know, sometimes uni arts departments, sometimes the new atheists think they can demolish Christianity with their new insights. But God is not scared. God is not scared of scathing criticism. God is not scared of the sharpest minds in the world questioning everything. God is not scared of their questions, and he is not scared of your questions. I'm so thankful that God put Ecclesiastes in the Bible because it reminds me that God is not scared of my questions. And a second reason I'm thankful that God gave us Ecclesiastes is because the teacher is so effective at kicking the foundation out from under my idols. I've got to say, I really loved Ecclesiastes when I was a teenager. That's why I was so familiar with it when my lit teacher started talking about it. You know those years when you're getting all this career advice, there's all these options before you and people are giving you suggestions about what you could do. Sometimes they'll give you upfront suggestions. Sometimes they'll give you subtle hints sort of thing. And they're sort of telling you what's important for life, what you should be valuing in life. You know, that really you should be living for career, you should be living for your lifestyle, you should be living for money, you should be living for security, you should be living for greatness. All these different things. These are the things that will give your life meaning. You know, a great one is, you know, to be thinking at the time is that money will give you reason. And then you get, the teacher says in Ecclesiastes 5 from verse 10, whoever loves money never has money enough. Isn't that true? Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. They put more effort into dodging tax than everybody else put together. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? In fact, he says, the sweat of the labourer is better off than the rich guy. He's great at demolishing our idols. You know, when I was facing all these choices in life and there were all these choices set out before me, I knew that if I said yes to one thing, This is something they forget to tell people these days. If you say yes to one thing, it means you're saying no to something else. You cannot do everything. And I knew that. And I see people who get paralysed when they're facing choices, because if they say yes to this, they could miss out on something really good over here. And wouldn't it be the end? But the teacher tells us, hey, it's all meaningless anyway. Don't stress about it. Most of you here are further on in our lives. Many of you feel that a lot of your life choices are set. But I encourage you to take time to read Ecclesiastes. Let the teacher attack the foolish things that we all turn to instead of God. You know, when you're tempted to think, well, life will be okay if I can just get, you know, that thing. Listen to the teacher's warning. The eye never has its full of seeing. It won't be okay when you got that. Nor the ear its full of hearing. What you are chasing will not satisfy you. When you're tempted to desire wealth instead of desiring God, listen to the teacher. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour. When you're tempted to build up your legacy instead of God's glory, remember the truth the teacher tells us. There is no remembrance of the men of old. See, I find the teacher's words smash through my meaningless pursuits, and they show me that they're nothing but a chasing after the wind. And there are times when the meaninglessness, the briefness, the and then gone of life come home to you. Actually, after working on this sermon this week, it really came home to me in the later part of the week. You know, sometimes we could get scared looking at this. We might become like the depressed people you find around philosophy departments. We might become suicidal. But got a call on Friday. Husband of one of Miriam's friends had suicided. And then cycling home, I got a big life or death scare on my bike. Rolled up to run the Auskick breakup the next morning, and two different people told me their parents had suddenly had their health crash and facing life and death things. And my friends, they were sort of saying, looking at all this, going, you just got to get the most out of it when you can. Make the best of your meaningless, brief life. And really, that's the conclusion that the teacher comes to as well. So if you look over in chapter 9, he says from verse 4 there, he says, yes, it's all meaningless, it's all pointless, but don't end it all, because it's better now than... You'll have nothing if you end it all. He says, verse 4, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog, that's a lovely comparison for you, isn't it? Even a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing and have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten, in case you missed it earlier. Their love and their hate and their jealousy have long since vanished, and never again will they have a part in anything under the sun. So what's this advice? This positive advice. Here you go. This is about as positive as it gets. Go, eat your food with gladness, and drink your wine with a joyful heart. All you vineyard people, are you happy about that? For it is now that God favours what you do. Always be clothed in white, and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy your life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labour under the sun. Whatever your hand primes to do, do your best at it. Or, you know, he's an existentialist, the teacher. He believes life is pointless, so just make the best of what you have. Or back in chapter 5, so verse 18 and 19 there, he says, well, then I realised it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given to him, for this is his lot. Moreover, When God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, well, this is a gift from God. Not the most uplifting, exciting conclusion ever, is it? It's interesting that it's a lot of the secular philosophers, it's about the best they could give you as well. I've just read the Hunger Games teenage series book. If you get to the end of that, that's pretty much their thing as well. It's all meaningless and pointless. There'll be injustice. You just try and be a bit happy in your little meaningless relationship you got now. But the conclusion to Ecclesiastes, which we'll look at in a few weeks, the compiler of this almost damns it with faint praise. He doesn't exactly say this is the most best thing you ever to read. He says it's worth reading. He doesn't say it's the best thing ever. And he picks up in particular on some points us instead to the teacher, but onto somewhere else at the end. There's a it's not just at the end, though. I won't go to the end now, but there's a fascinating thing through all the teacher says. And that is that he knows God is there and God is real. He looked around at the world and seen the evidence there. He believes God is real. And the teacher has great advice about remembering God. So, say the start of chapter 5, verse 1. He says there, this is good advice. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen, rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who do not know that they do wrong. Approach God and his word and his house with humility, and go to listen. Go to learn when you come to church. Go to learn when you meet with your brothers and sisters in Christ. Go to learn when you come to the Bible. Because God is God, you are not. You see in the next verse, do not be quick with your mouth or be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven. He has a real perspective, and you are on earth. So let your words be few. It's good advice. But does the teacher actually follow his advice? You ever had wise people give advice and you notice they don't struggle to actually do it themselves? The teacher is also down on earth. He doesn't see from the big perspective. He doesn't want to build his wisdom, though. He refuses to build his wisdom on what God has revealed in Scripture. He builds his wisdom on what he sees himself. The teacher states in other places that God will judge. But then he ignores all the revelation about how God will judge. The teacher doesn't even mention other things God says about God saving his people and the hope God gives us. He prefers to make his judgments himself. He prefers really to sit there in judgment on God. The teacher wants to judge by what he sees, by what he thinks, by what he hears. Are you like the teacher in that way? Really, if it comes down to it, you want to sit there as the judge over God and over his works. Do you spend more time sprouting your own wisdom than listening to God's wisdom? Just a few verses later, the teacher advises us in verse 7, much dreaming and many words are meaningless. Therefore, stand in awe of God. He calls us to stand in awe of God. But he's accumulated his much words and much wisdom here. And he seems to stand in awe more of his own wisdom than of God. The miserable example of the teacher is a warning to us not to overvalue our own wisdom, our own judgment. So then what gives life meaning? Is it possible to live a life worth living, and live a life with meaning, with purpose? Or are we all just fooling ourselves so we can just make the best of a bad situation? As I said, in the coming few weeks I'll look more at the points in Ecclesiastes towards hope. But as this week's the first week in Ecclesiastes, and the last few weeks we have looked at people who know their lives are meaningful. For the last few months, we've been looking at people who have a purpose, who see something worth living for. We've been looking at the book of Acts, which has the account of the spread of the early church, of the early Christians and the apostles. And I want you to just take a moment now to contrast the teacher with his own wisdom and the apostles. To contrast their perspectives, the teacher's perspective with the apostles' perspective. Contrast their messages, the teacher's message with the apostles' message. Their hope, to contrast their lives, the teacher's life with the apostles' lives. I mean, from the perspective, the teacher speaks from the perspective under the sun. His wisdom is all from what he could see, from what he could experience for himself. His perspective, he gets his authority from his own wisdom. He's really the ultimate source of authority. And he's depressingly aware that that will be cut short by death. But the apostles see more. They know Jesus has brought heaven's perspective to earth. God has come down and revealed himself to us. We have a greater perspective than what's under the sun. And the apostles speak with the authority of the risen Jesus. And the teacher, what's his message? The teacher brings, what is his message? Meaningless. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Futility. Angst. You might as well make the best of your meaningless life, though. But the apostles bring God's message of life and purpose. Jesus died to pay for our foolishness, for our refusal to consider God, for our sin, for our injustice. He died to pay for that, and Jesus has risen as God's great ruler. He will bring life to anyone who will trust in him, rely on him, anyone who will recognize his authority. That is a message worth hearing. And if you contrast the hope of the teacher and the hope of the apostles, what is the teacher's hope? I look around. I talk to people. I think, what is their hope? What would be left after they take what the teacher demolishes? What is the teacher's hope? It's pretty much nothing, isn't it? But the apostles have the sure hope of the resurrection. For all who repent and believe, there is real hope. Not the vain hope of just money and riches or of the legacy the teacher saw and attacks. But true hope, the hope of God's children have, that we will be celebrating with God as his treasured people forever. That is a hope worth having. And we see this if we contrast their lives, the teacher's life and the apostles' lives. The teacher is a king living in luxury. But he's overcome by the futility of life. Do you see this around you? He cannot find meaning despite all his wisdom. But the apostles have purpose, they have meaning, they have security for eternity and their lives. They see the value in it. You see, no matter what is thrown at them, whether they're in jail, whether they're shipwrecked, whether they're persecuted, no matter what happens, they have a dignity, they have joy. I love the picture of them singing hymns to God in jail, shackled. They have meaning, their lives have meaning because they are taking out the life-giving message of Jesus Christ to the world. So I encourage you to read through the book of Ecclesiastes. Listen to the teacher. Learn from the teacher. But do not be like the teacher.